Hello everyone, welcome to today's episode. My name is Researcher Jove, and today actually marks the 20th episode I've made. And I just want to thank everyone who's been able to check out the podcast, and I know it may be confusing sometimes, or maybe like not everyone's cup of tea, but I enjoy making them, and I'm glad some people enjoy them as well. And I really love the stories from the SCP Wiki. I think the writers are so creative, and it's just interesting the stories they come up with. Going forward, I am going to try to do themes, however, such as looking at all of the SCP-1 or 01 proposals, because there's so many of them, or looking at various groups of interest, such as the Chaos Insurgency, Sarcism, and Dr. Wondertainment. But, you know, just looking at different aspects in the SCP universe, but trying to categorize them more so it's like, I guess, easier to understand and, like, follow along. For today, however, we're going to be looking at a tale from the SCP Wiki rather than a document. This tale connects with previous episodes where I've covered SCP-093, the Red Sea Object, which appears as a red disk that allows the travel through mirrors into another world, and SCP-1867, a gentleman, Object Class Safe, which is a sea slug who refers to himself as Lord Blackwood. This tale looks at a time before Lord Blackwood was a sea slug, when he was still an explorer slash naturalist, and when he first heard about the Red Stone. He had decided to travel through a mirror to the other world to explore it for himself. There he finds a world far more advanced than the one he has come from, and seems to be heavily involved in a religion similar to Christianity, but has been heavily altered by what their world calls a second coming, where a godlike being gave their world highly advanced technology and weapons. One such weapon turns people in that their society deems as sinful into gray, blobless mass, and leaves the land that it touches barren and infertile. Lord Blackwood ends up finding a way to stop these beings, but first gets into a bit of a tight spot with the law of the land. Now that I've given some background, let's look at the tale. Lord Blackwood in the Land of the Unclean. This tale is written as a diary, so I will be reading it in that way. December 25th, 1875. As far as wide as I have traveled in my years, there's nothing in the world quite like Christmas time in London. The crisp winter air echoes with the song of carolers, and everywhere everyone looks, the eyes of his fellow man are filled with an air of peace and charity. I gave the help the day off after our early meal, and have spent the evening in quiet reflection and planning. For this Christmas, the germ of a grand and glorious new expedition has presented itself to me. Two nights ago, I attended a Christmas party at the Gentlemen's Club. The food was fine, and the drinks flowed freely, and I remained in conversation with several of my fellow naturalists until well into the morning. Shortly after midnight, our discussions turned towards the topic of the supernatural, and Mr. Wallace, the famed father of the evolutionary theory, and a noted spiritualist, told me of a most unusual occurrence that he had heard of recently. An associate of his had recently returned from the Levant with a most unusual artifact, a small red disc, fashioned perhaps of cinnabar, covered with runes that he thought to be an early form of Phoenician, or perhaps Cretan. When left to its own devices, the object would roll about on its own and reach great speeds, breaking through walls and crushing anything in its path, until it came to rest upon a mirrored surface. A man could easily pick up the object, no matter how fast it moved, he claimed, and until it was set down, it would glow brightly in strange colors. We found this account most curious, but Mr. Wallace told us next proved even more interesting. Two months ago, he said, his associate's maid had been cleaning the room where the disc lay pressed against one of the dresser mirrors. Ignorant to the object's nature, the maid lifted the object up to dust underneath it, and when set upon the mirror, the surface of the mirror rippled, and a man in strange clothing fell through, as if he had been leaning upon the wall that gave way. The man panicked and began flailing about and shouting nonsensical, and tried to flee before the maid locked him in a room and summoned the police, who then took the man as he shouted and tried to run back in the direction of the room he had appeared. Mr. Wallace's associate had thought him at first to be a common thief, but there was absolutely no way the man could have entered the estate without arousing suspicion, and the maid's account was most clear. He had come through the mirror. I have long wondered if there were other worlds in creation where man, or beings like men, have existed and thrived. But owing to the vast greatness of space, I have long assumed that none of these would be within our reach for some time. If Mr. Wallace's account was true, there might be a way to travel to one of these worlds right here in London. I entreated with Mr. Wallace for some time to divulge the name of his confederate. He refused out of respect for the friend's privacy, but told me that the strange intruder who claimed the name Ezekiel Belson had been declared mad by the court and sentenced to Bedlam, and that I might find him there if I wished. After New Year's, I intended to call upon this madman. January 3rd, 1876. The fact that an institution like Bedlam is allowed to exist in our great nation is an affront. Were a man not already mad upon entering the walls, the circumstances of his internment would make him so. I did my best to avert my eyes from the lunatics packed into dingy cells and overcrowded wards as a porter led me into a padded cell where a man called Ezekiel Belson had been locked away alone. None of the doctors had been able to speak to him, she said. If I wished to try, I was more than welcome to do so. A gruff-looking jailer with a large and ancient-looking key ring unlocked the door, and I invited myself in, where Mr. Belson sat alone in a corner. I introduced myself and said that I had come to learn what I could about who he was and where he came from. He did not respond at first and turned his head away, mumbling under his breath. I listened carefully, found that the tongue he spoke almost resembled the English language, but was far from any tongue that I have ever heard spoken in the Queen's Court. Twisted and altered as if by centuries of deviation, not dissimilar from how the many and various Romance languages evolved amidst the collapse of the Roman Empire. I stood and listened attentively as he repeated a series of sentences three times that I present below. Hi who are between space, pressed is your voice. Ye are watching in I your vessel, here and there. Away with me, sin, vader, and share for me your staggering weepin', and I'll but do the word of the vader below sea. The man's accent was strange, and it was partway through his third resuscitation that it occurred to me that he was attempting to pray. I knew the prayer well, and when he had finished his third recitation, I repeated it back to him in the Queen's English. He fell silent as he heard my rendition. His first reaction was more ventriloquial than I expected. I believe he accused me of having the speech of the old elders, and accused me of being a sinner or a witch. I assured him as best I could that I was neither, that I am a naturalist. He seemed to calm himself somewhat when he heard that word. In any event, he no longer feared me, and over the course of an hour or two, we worked out a pigeon of English in his dialect in which we can converse. In time, I came to the conclusion that he hails from a world that is surprisingly like and yet completely alien to our own. Mr. Belson claims to have come from a place called the City Where Elijah Fell. He describes it as a metropolis that would put London to shame. Tens of millions of souls call it home, living in towers thousands of feet high, commuting on great trains and horseless carriages that moved hundreds of miles per hour through packed streets. Every building was wired with electricity, and possess devices for receiving sights and sound from other ends of the world, and delivering and contained knowledge of entire libraries and other incredible wonders. I showed him a map of the world and asked where the city lay. He pointed to America on the western coast of the Floridian Palencia. He claimed he had been working at the time in one of the city's great towers, momentarily leaning against a wall during a prayer break when the wall seemed to fade away and he fell through, finding himself in a strange house with a strangely dressed woman screaming at him, confirming Mr. Wallace's account. I showed him a Bible I procured from the doctors and asked him if he was a Christian. He recoiled at the proposition as he had when I recited the Lord's Prayer, and informed me that, while the elders had been Christians in days gone by, all that had changed with the Second Coming and the authoring of the Third Testament, and that to openly proclaim to be Christian was heresy and a most heinous crime. I gather that in the nation Mr. Belson hails from, which he claims to control the entire world, the church and the state have been brought together in a way that would make the Archbishop of Canterbury himself a proponent of disestablishment. I asked what became of heretics when they were caught, and he informed me that they were made pure in his tears, for if heresy is allowed to spread unchecked, then the unclean shall come and bring destruction to the pure and the wicked alike. Mr. Belson refused to elaborate further when I asked him what the unclean were. He asserted that it was blasphemy to even speak of them, for saying their name might draw their attention. I assured him that nobody in London would harm him for speaking of this matter, and that whatever an unclean might be, there was none in any of this corner of the world that I have explored. Belson was visibly frightened as he told me, in halting whispers, that the unclean were the devil. But unlike the devil of the heretics, who lived in the pits below, these devils walked and lived among the earth. They were giant creatures, behemoths of pure sin, all of man's unrighteousness and deeds given flesh. They stalked the darkest corners of the world, and their sins tainted the earth itself so that no crop could grow and no man could live. And it took all the efforts of the holiest crusaders to keep them so imprisoned, lest they break free and the world come to an end. Until such time as the doctor assured me I must leave for the night, I remained in Mr. Belson's cell and learned as much as I could from the strange world he comes from. Matters of language, culture, fashion, everything a man might need to know to travel amongst its gleaming cities anonymously. I managed to convince a young nurse at the clerk's desk into letting me review Mr. Velson's file, and I learned that the fray that led to his arrest occurred in Notting Hill, at the residence of Mr. Weathers. Tomorrow I shall call upon him and state my intent to purchase this disc that turns mirrors into gateways to another world, for I intend to conduct a survey of this civilization to rival Sir Burton's Forbidden into Mecca. Sir Burton's Forbidden Journey into Mecca, and if I can, find one of these diabolical monsters Mr. Belson speaks of, and make it my prey. January 9th, 1876. Mr. Weathers was quite relieved when I told him I wanted to purchase the disc. It glowed an eerie purple as he handed it to me, and yet, once in my own hands, its aura seemed to fade, and instead become a greenish hue. I took it home and placed it on a mirror in my study, and immediately the glass seemed to become as water. I saw a pastoral scene not unlike that which one might behold in our own countryside. A farmhouse in the distance, tilled fields with tall crops between them. There were children running and playing among the crops, and in the distance, over the horizon, I saw in silhouette titanic structures taller than any building man on this earth has ever made. For several days, I observed the mirror. On few occasions, I saw the farmer and his farmhands come close enough that I could hear their speech. The accent, not as thick as Mr. Belson's had been, but foreign enough that I strained to decipher their conversations. The clothes they wore were not unlike those of a farmhand might wear in England, but Mr. Belson had warned me that the fashions of the city were very different from what I'd seen. But Mr. Belson had warned me the fashions in the city were very different from what he had seen in London, and I would be most out of place in any of my usual attire. A visit to the Metropolitan Police after a lengthy conversation with the precinct constable and the promise of a sizable donation, I was able to acquire the clothes Mr. Belson had been wearing at the time when he entered our world. It was not dissimilar to morning dress, but to my eye, it seemed less formal. There was no waistcoat, the jacket was shorter and cut more conservatively with broad lapels, and the cravat was thin and a solid shade of black. I had Deeds tailor it to fit me, and I stowed it away for when I reached the city. I'd pack lightly, for I shall be traveling alone, and I shall have none of the native currency, for Mr. Belson had carried no billfold when entering our world. I have my clothes and rations for a few days, and shall enter dressed in a farmer's garb, and remain so until I reach the metropolis. Gold and silver I have brought in the hopes of trading for currency, Mr. Belson having informed me that the principal form of trade is paper, and within my pack I have hidden my pistol and several of Mr. Moss's weapons. I have my compass, my sextant, my electric torch, a comprehensive atlas of the world, and my journal, as well as a few good luck talismans besides those. The cycle of day and night in this world is some 8 hours or so behind ours. From this, I deduce that the scene I behold is somewhere along the western coast of America. I shall cross through the looking glass under cover of night this evening, for fear of alarming the farmers of my presence, and will make my way towards the city, where hopefully I can discover a library or an institution of learning and document the history and culture of this world, and where the so-called unfertile zones are located, so that I might observe one of these unclean for myself. January 10th, 1876. What a world this is indeed. This is indeed one of the more temperate parts of the world, for though it was past midnight local time when I entered the world, the air was perfectly warm. Based on my reading of the stars, I judged myself to be somewhere near the 34th parallel in the region that must be in this world correspond to the land of California. Here in the fields it is dark, but in the southeast I behold a stunning panorama of light shining into the darkness. The aura of the great metropolis bathed in electric light so bright that it shrouds the stars above them. In the distance I heard sounds like great engines. The terrain was easily passed, even in the darkness, save for a fence at the edge of the farm that I had to hop over. The sight I beheld when I reached the source of the noise was unbelievable. A great paved road lay stretched across the grassland, solid barriers at either side. It was wider than any road I have ever beheld, and strips painted on the road indicated 16 lanes for traffic, 8 going one direction and 8 going the other. The entire road was lit by giant lamps, brighter than the gas lamps of London or New York, and one could have read a newspaper comfortably by their light. Even at this late hour, I watched in surprise and wonder, and no small amount of terror, I must admit, as motor carriages far more advanced than Mr. Bolly's steam cars hurled along the road at speeds faster than the finest locomotive or the fastest racehorse. They must have been traveling at 100 miles per hour or more, some of them small enough to carry a handful of people, while others were massive like train cars and looking to haul cargo by the ton. Some never touched the roadway at all, seeming to glide on a cushion of air. I had to sit by the road, obscured in shadow, for some time while I took this in. Many times in my life, I have encountered savage tribes that have never before seen the wonders of civilization. At this moment, I felt the savage myself, beholding wonders he had no hope of contemplating. I dared not cross the road, as it seemed like a straightway enough path to the city, I walked for several hours along its shoulder. It was difficult to tell in the darkness, but it looked to be about 30 miles to the outskirts of the city, and I judged it would take well past midday to reach the inhabited areas. I feared that any of the carriages hurtling by might at any moment careen out of control and catastrophe would ensue, and I wondered how any man could bear such speeds. The eastern sky was beginning to show the tint of dawn when one of the carriages slowed to a stop at the edge of the road next to me, and a door opened with a voice from within asking if I desired a ride into the city. I've never been one to rely on the charity of strangers, but I was curious to examine one of the carriages from the inside, and accepted. It was scarcely a quarter of an hour before we were among the crystalline towers of the metropolis. I did my best to disguise my terror as the driver, who identified himself as Bin Okazim, inquired about my business to the city. I told him my name was Tidor Swordwa, that Mr. Belson had told me how my name would be said, that I was a farmhand in the nearby countryside, and that I had never been to the city before, and that I had intended to research my family's history at one of the major libraries therein. We struggled to understand each other, as I had not yet fully mastered the dialect, but his assumption that I was merely a country boy saved me from any uncomfortable questions. I disembarked in the financial center of the city and offered to pay him for the ride with one of my gold slugs. He refused, saying it was far too much for a simple ride, and so I offered him a silver slug instead, which he accepted and offered me a considerable sum of paper currency in the balance, while commenting that he had never imagined the country folk to have such wealth at their disposal. The metropolis, which I now know to be called the City of Angelic Glory, is easily larger than any city in all the world. I imagine the entire population of my world could fit in this city. There is a great bustle everywhere in the city, and yet there is a desperation and a fear that underlies it all. Nobody meets anyone's gaze, and every man seems to be constantly fearing and to suspect one another. With the banknotes Mr. Okazim had given me, I breakfasted at one of the bustling cafes, where I enjoyed a meal barely dissimilar from a full breakfast one can find at any reputable establishment in London, and I found board in a grand hotel named the St. George. Imagine my surprise when I was told my room would be on the 78th floor, an electric lift that would make Mr. Otis's green with envy whisked me to impossible heights in mere seconds, and I found myself staring out at a window at the gargantuan city. Towers like the one I stood in jutted out in all directions, many of them extending hundreds of feet even above my own vantage point. Highways not unlike the one that took me into the city crisscrossed the metropolis and formed a ring around its perimeter. I beheld a massive network of smaller roads and railways. The hotel concierge had given me directions to the city or to the civic library. Tomorrow I shall seek it out, but for now I must close the curtains on this impossible scene and rest, for I find myself overwhelmed and weary. January 11th, 1876. My finding at this city's great library have shed much light into the nature of the world I find myself in. The library itself stood 12 levels high, not as tall as many of the other buildings in the City of Angelic Glory, but easily taller than any institution of learning in London. A librarian guided me to the 8th level, where I would find books of history and geography, and I spent the day immersed in study. Though the books are written in strange letters that do not resemble any I have ever seen, I have found myself some somehow able to understand them as if they were common English writing. A comparison of the world map to the one in my own atlas confirmed that I was in the land of California, and in about the same area as a town in my world that would be known as Los Angeles. Many great cities in this world stood in the same places as cities in my own, though none shared the same name. London here was called the City of Winston Stan, and Edo was called the City of David's Triumph. I saw no national boundaries on the map, though there were many names indicating different regions. The United Lands Under the Sun, Hufasia, and the Land Bountiful. The only division indicated were between the Blessed Lands, colored green, and the Infertile Lands, colored red. There were infertile lands spread across the globe, though I found the distribution most uneven. In North America, I saw but 7, and in Europe, 4, while in Africa, Africa had dozens, and almost the entirety of China was covered by them. But I found that the Bible had existed in this world, though it was very unlike the Bible I had known. It was about 1,000 pages longer, and is divided into 3 sections, named the First, Second, and Third Testament. The First and Second Testaments are similar to the Old and New Testaments of our Bible, but have been extensively rewritten. All references to God, the Lord, or our Father have simply been replaced by Him. And there's a greater emphasis on sin, on cleanliness, and purification than I ever recall learning about in Sunday school. The Third Testament appears to have been written in the 17th century, and as I had not the entire time or inclination to read the book, I referred to a history book about what is referred to in this world as the Second Coming. Prior to the year 1621 or so, I found the history of this world had been much like our own, aside from certain linguistics or cultural details, and an indication that the widespread colonization of the Americas had begun several hundred years earlier. In that year, the being called Him made himself known to the people of the world, and nations worldwide proclaimed it to be their God. He provided them with great advancements in technology and medicine, which were the impetus of the advanced civilization I now beheld. But war broke out across the world over the question of which nation were most worthy of his love. When he beheld the devastation that his children wrought, he wept, and where his tears fell, those who tasted of them were purified of sin and lost their inclination to fight. But those who refused to cease in strife, those who were consumed by sin and evil, their wickedness was manifested in his absence, and took the form until it became the unclean, the giant abominations that to this day lurk in the unfertile lands. All life that the unclean encounter is utterly destroyed. Men, women, animals, even plants are all consumed by the creatures and then vanish into thin air, leaving behind only an ichor of sin and discharge from when it feeds. Agents of the church known as the Blessed Militia guard these lands, and do so with constant battle to keep the unclean imprisoned within the infertile lands. In time, the United Lands of the Sun brought together the nations of the world under the rule of a theocracy, governed by a man called the Most Holy Father. There were 10 ranks of the clergy, from the Most Holy Father himself to the Blessed Father at the bottom, whose hierarchy comprised not only of the church, but the courts, the legislature, and the executive powers of government. The judicial system was not unlike English law, though it incorporated elements similar to the canon law of the Roman Church. And the clergy were exempt from this direct judgment, for only the Most Holy himself could pass judgment onto them. The death penalty here was unknown. Those who had committed great crimes were buried in a compound called the tears, supposedly refined from his own weepings. And if they survive the trial, the urge to sin is cleansed from their system. As luck would have it, one of the few unfertile lands in this country is located in the deserts a few hundred miles east of the city. On one of the maps I spotted a railway line that draws dangerously close to this border. Interestingly enough, I noticed that almost every city had a rail line leading directly into the infertile lands as well, but those were marked as for militia use only, and I deemed them inaccessible. Tomorrow I shall travel to the train that passes this border and find a way to depart as close to the edge as possible, and determine whether I can smuggle myself into this forbidden land. I know not how much of this history I've read is true, and how much of the hagiography concocted by the church, or how much of it is hagiography concocted by the church, but soon I shall find out for myself. January 14th, 1876. I am lucky to have escaped the events of the past few days with my life, but even now I may be doomed. My entry into this unfertile land was uneventful. I was able to excuse myself stealthily from the train during a brief stop, and hiked but a few miles under the desert sun to the edge. The perimeter in this region was guarded only by a fence with a prominent signage saying, "Warning. Unfertile lands, unclean within. Blessed militia only beyond this point." By order of the Regional High Father, City of St. Francis Triumph. The blessed militia, I assumed, must have some means of tracking the unclean to prevent them from crossing the borders of the country. I, on the other hand, would have to rely on luck and providence alone. I could smell the unclean for hours before I spotted it. Nothing grows in this land, and there is no running water, nor is there so much a buzzard in the sky, but the air hangs heavy with the undeniable stench of death, worse than the foulest Scottish abattoir and the banks of the putrid Ganges. I could have been sick, but I steeled myself and pressed onward in the direction from which the stench seemed to be the strongest. I assembled and readied my destabilizing musket I had carried in my pack, a special model from Mr. Moth, who had prepared it especially for this expedition, and bringing to bear considerably more potential for atomic disassembly than the standard models. I spotted it after climbing a ridge and almost turned around and retreated right away, but I had expected the creature to be the size of a man, or not much larger. The abomination I held before me was easily 500 feet long and dozens of feet tall. It was almost in the shape of a man, but had no legs or torso. Two arms that seemed to grow and shrink as they moved dragged a massive trunk across the desert sands, while a head with no face seemed to loll and stare at nothing in particular. Its skin, the tone of a white man's, was smooth and hairless across its entire body, and it made no sound as it seemed to crawl about aimlessly. A brown ichor seemed to ooze from it before quickly evaporating. It was no wonder the people of this world thought these things to be the devil's made flesh. Even with my heavy destabilizer at the ready, I was obviously ill-equipped to hunt a creature of this size. I observed it for several hours as it seemed to crawl aimlessly in the same general area, with no particular direction or agenda, taking notes and making sure to make sketches. It was late in the afternoon when I determined that I would have to turn around. A train bound in the opposite direction would pass by shortly after nightfall, and I intended to board it and return to the city. But luck was not with me. As I stood from my hiding spot upon the ridge, the unclean's head turned in my direction, and it stopped its nonsensical crawling about. Though it had no eyes or ears, it somehow knew I was there. And though it had no mouth, the abomination let out a blood-curdling moan that echoed for miles. One of the creature's giant arms stretched out in my direction and began to drag itself towards me. I had no choice but to stand and fight. I raised my musket at the creature and took careful aim and fired. The unclean was wholly unaffected by the bolt from my musket, which seemed to harmlessly pass through it and dissipate in the atmosphere. In seconds, it was before me, and I was sure I was about to die. The creature loomed above me, resting itself on its giant hands, as a face bore down upon me. Before it could presumably devour me whole, I heard a massive rapport, and a giant shell struck the unclean in the face and exploded. I was showered with a foul-smelling brown ichor as the beast's face was torn apart, and though the wound seemed to heal itself rather quickly, more and more shells struck it in the face, the trunk, and the arms. It stumbled, and I ran to avoid it, as men in dark-colored uniforms decorated with symbols like those I had found on the disc that allowed me to travel into this world were using weapons. Pounded it with artillery. It lurched at them, and one of the soldiers was devoured whole by the creature, its clothes and weapons falling to the ground as the man vanished. Soon it could take no more as the barricade continued, and it turned around and fled back into the desert. I retreated into the direction from which I had come to find a convoy of armored motor carriages armed with heavy cannons. I attempted to run, but in seconds the soldiers surrounded me and apprehended me in the name of the blessed militia. I was told I was lucky to be alive after attempting such a foolish pursuit, and that I would be put to the question by the court of blessed voice. My situation was compounded when one of the soldiers searched my pack and found one of my good luck charms, a small golden cross that had been given to me by the Patriarch of Alexandria during my exploits there in 1855. The soldiers immediately declared me a heretic, and some were of the opinion that I should be shot then and there, or taken back to the unclean to be devoured. In either event, I was bound with steel cuffs and escorted to a prison cell, where I now await trial. They do not know I still have this journal, though if I am convicted of heresy and put to the tears, it may not longer matter. January 16th, 1876. I was brought before the court of the Blessed Voices yesterday. The scene I found myself in looked like a scene out of the Spanish Inquisition. Three men in arcane robes beheld me from atop a judge's bench, while I stood in the dock, guarded by the blessed militia. The senior judge advised me I had been accused of heresy and trespassing in the unfertile lands, and I faced the tears, and demanded my plea. No lawyer had been provided of me, and I expected nothing resembling a fair trial if I contested the charges. Yet, if I plead guilty, I would surely be put to the tears and my mind torn apart by the mysterious concoction. Recalling that the laws of the land were similar to those of medieval England, and that no member of the priesthood might be tried, I took a gamble and insisted that I was a man of the cloth, and that hereby entitled to benefit of clergy, an ancient rite of which a holy man could avoid persecution by proving his ability to read from the Bible. The judges were most skeptical of this proposition. Even in this nation, the benefit of clergy was an outdated rite, for many people could read these days than simply just the priesthood. A reference to their legal text, however, found that the rite had never been disestablished. I was told I could attempt to exercise that benefit if I wished, but that it would then be up to the Most High Father himself to judge my fate, and he would not be as forgiving as this court. I hoped for nothing less than to play for time, and I agreed. It was decided that I would be expected to read three verses from the Bible. One of the strange Bibles of this world was placed before me and opened to the Third Testament, and I was asked to read a passage called Edward 7:22. As before, The strange lettering of this world's language made itself clear to me, and I read, "Be free of sin, therefore, as he and his angels are free of sin. For wherever sin transpires in the heart of men, the unclean walk among us." Next, the book was opened to the First Testament, and I was asked to read Psalm 23:4. It was most unlike the version I had learned in chapel many years ago, but I read it clear and true. "Though I walk in the land of the unclean, I will fear no evil, for you are always watching, your voice and your sight protecting me." I was surprised when the judge closed the book and proclaimed that I would have to prove myself by reciting the third verse from memory. I was challenged to recite Matthew 5:38-39 from the Second Testament. I knew the verse well enough in the King James Bible, but I have no way of knowing how it might have been presented in this world, or even enough of their strange theology to guess. I felt doom creep upon me and decided to do the best I could as I closed my eyes to recite the verse I knew. "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, and yet whoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him also the other." The judges did not at first respond to this reading. They retreated from their bench to discuss among themselves for a few moments, and one departed briefly, returning with a truly ancient book that they examined while conferring further. I wondered if reciting the verse in its original form might have only confirmed their accusations of me. When my bonds were removed and I was ordered to follow the chief judge to his chambers, seated behind a magnificent desk of fine ebony, the chief judge informed me that I had correctly recited the verse in question, as it had existed in the ancient Bible before the Second Coming. Those old texts were forbidden to the public. Even the heretic sects made do with modern versions, and the only known copies in existence were in possession of the church fathers themselves for their own personal study. The book he had examined was the only ancient Bible in the entire city, and before today had not been removed from the safekeeping for over 50 years. And yet, I knew its verses by heart. Therefore, he said, I was obviously, at the very least, a holy father, one of the third highest in the system, who had traveled incognito to his land for some purpose. Though he had no power as a mere blessed voice to compel my obedience, he asked why I had come and what I had been doing in the infertile lands with the heretic's cross and a strange weapon that was useless against the unclean. An opportunity had been granted to me, and I chose to take advantage of it. I was, I informed the blessed voice, a senior member of the church's scientific research division, conducting tests on the development of improved weapons for the suppressing or even killing of the unclean. I told him that my destabilizing musket was a product of this project, and it had shown promise in tests against tissue samples, and that I had been delegated to test it for myself in the field. Unfortunately, it had not lived up to its promise, and further refinements would obviously be needed before it could live up to its full potential. The cross, I claimed, was merely a trophy I'd taken from a heretic in the priesthood after I exposed his treason. To my surprise, the blessed voice did not question my account at all. So great the respect for and fear of authority is within the nation, I suspect that the mere idea that I was his superior was enough to put me beyond reproach. By the end of our meeting, he had offered me access to a laboratory in the Blessed Militia's base at the edge of the unfertile zone. I accepted his proposition, and today I found myself examining a facility that makes the laboratory at my own home look like a child's plaything. It is fully appointed with every instrument a man of science could want for, and several that I do not yet fully understand myself. There are full stocks of chemicals, as well as tissue samples acquired from the unclean, samples of their Icarus discharge, and a variety of medical nutrients and fluids, including the mind-altering substance called the Lord's Tears. I have been given private quarters within the base, and the militiamen give me a wide berth. I have noticed they avert their eyes as I pass them the halls, and all conversation ceases when I enter the room. They believe I hold power over their very lives, and for now at least, I shall make no effort to disabuse them of this notion. It shall take me some time, but perhaps with this equipment and the samples provided, I can learn enough of the nature of the unclean to genuinely construct a weapon capable of causing true damage to them. If only Deeds were here. At least then I would have a capable lab assistant. February 27th, 1876. I've made a truly horrifying breakthrough in my research today. I do not even know if the most senior leaders of this world knew the truth. Some of them must surely know if a heretic from another world was able to figure it out so quickly. And they have gone to great lengths to hide it from their world in the lie of a religion. The beings called unclean are not devils or beings of pure sin, but gross mutations of the human form itself. The key to this transition is the tears. I know not what the true origin of that compound is, or from where it came, but it is more than a simple tool for mind control. When human flesh is exposed to a significant enough concentration, it changes. The bonds that hold the atoms together peel away, and it becomes mutable and elastic, folding around and absorbing all of their life introduced to it. A single mutant becomes two, then three, then four, growing larger and larger, becoming less and less human in form, until it becomes an unclean. I wonder how these creatures first came to be created. Did the church fathers make weapons of this and unleash it upon the renegade nations that refused to submit to their will? Perhaps they still use it for that reason. I had found numerous reports in history books of cities and countrysides being attacked by unclean, suddenly loosed from their infertile lands, whenever a sentiment of that land had turned against the church. Even now, they continue to throw millions of people into the tears every year to better control them. Some of them surely must be mutating as a result and becoming the basis of a new abomination. No wonder there were railways leading into the infertile zones. It was necessary to dispose of the persons so changed. I wondered how many sacrificed intentionally to make the unclean more powerful and more menacing as a weapon of terror. I wonder what might happen if news of this horror became known to the people. How many more heretics would the elders throw into the tears? How many cities would they loose the unclean upon to suppress the threat to their power? How many uprisings could they manage? How many mutants could take form before the unclean became uncontrollable and society itself was brought to its knees? I shudder to think. But with this horror has come revelation. The unclean are born using the tears to allow people to absorb others into themselves. What if a compound could be produced that weakens those bonds? I think I can develop a way to produce a variant of the tears that will counter the effect the original has on these poor souls. I owe it to the people of this world to at least try. March 20th, 1876. Today is a day I shall remember for the rest of my life. After weeks of research, I have produced my weapon, a serum which I have, with no small amount of pride, named Blackwood's Tears. I have tested it on tissue samples of the unclean and watched them dissolve before my very eyes. It took several days of experimenting with one of the most sophisticated repeater rifles used by the militiamen of this world, but I have developed a custom rifle that fires syringes filled with Blackwood tears. Upon impact, the force should activate the plunge device and inject the serum directly into its target. I have produced several hundred rounds of the serum and loaded them into magazines. If my calculations prove true, it should only take about a few dozen to destroy one of the abominations. Yesterday, I spoke to a colonel of the militiamen who confirmed that the trains do go into the infernal zones to carry people who the fathers have declared incurably sinful, though he did not know the true meaning of that infamous phrase. He said a highly purified vial of the tears was contained on each train, which lured the unclean to it. Thus, the incurable were disposed of and the unclean were kept too far from wandering off. I arranged for the train to be sent out this morning empty, but for myself, my weapon, and the purified tears. Before I left, I gave a copy of my findings to the general or the colonel and made him promise to read it entirely, including my opinions on what would happen if the knowledge becomes widely known, and to make sure that Blackwood's tears were being manufactured around the world before that day came. He nodded in silent agreement as the train pulled away. Shortly before noon, the train parked itself at a dead end in the middle of the desert. I readied my weapon and waited in a blind outside the train as the stench of the unclean began to fill the air. As I watched, the abomination approached. I sighted it face through the remarkably sophisticated scope on the weapon and loosed the first round. The unclean screamed with a fury unimaginable. I almost dropped my gun and collapsed in agony, but as I watched through the scope, the creature lurched and seemed to grow a few feet smaller than it had been before. I fired another round, and a piece seemed to vanish from its head, but now it had its sights on me and was coming in my direction. I loosed several more rounds before I was forced to run. Pieces of flesh seemed to be sloughing off the creature as it dragged itself in my direction. Its screams pierced the air with a deafening madness. I ran blindly, turning occasionally to fire, and changing magazines from time to time. Alas, I had been paying more attention to the creature behind me than the terrain in front of me. I found myself boxed in, and as I turned around to fire, I had discovered the gun appeared to jam. The unclean was less than half the size it had been before. It dragged itself in my direction, slowed, but still unrelenting, as I furiously tried to clear the jam. It screamed as it raised itself above me. Somehow, in its wounded state, the monster seemed more human than it had before. Across every inch of its giant skin, I seemed to behold a different face, and each furious proclamation it made seemed to echo with hundreds of voices in fear and agony. I was still trying to clear the jam when it began to bear down onto me, and I thought I would soon join the souls that compromised its facial features. But when the titanic head was barely feet away from me, the unclean held itself motionless above me and stopped. It could have moved in for the kill at any moment, but instead it waited as I cleared the jam, and seconds later, my weapon was ready to fire. I understood. The unclean was an abomination of accursed souls in eternal pain and confusion, seeking a release that was forever denied. The thing before me wanted to die. I aimed my weapon, closed my eyes, and emptied the magazine into the faceless visage as it screamed a final time, and the scream was instantly cut short, echoing across the desert before dissipating entirely. When I opened my eyes, a scene of utter carnage lay before me. Of the unclean itself, there was no sign. But instead, hundreds of men and women and children, naked as the day when they were born, lay sprawled across the desert plains, dead or dying. I walked among them and saw young and old, gasping for air in their final moments. For none of them lasted more than a few moments before expiring. Among the crowd, I spotted a face I recognized, a soldier of the blessed militia who had been killed. The soldier of the blessed militia who had been killed when they first retrieved me. So I had thought at the time. As I looked at the dying man's eyes, his eyes met mine and spoke two words. Thank you. I made my way back west in the direction I had intended to flee in January, and boarded the train back to the City of Angelic Glory. The faster I can put this scene and these unfertile lands behind me, the better it shall be for my sanity. March 23rd, 1876. I returned through the mirror to London before dawn, in the morning of this world, arriving back in my study just after noon, London time. I was most thankful to find the gateway still worked. I had not expected to be away as long as I have been, and feared it might have ceased functioning or the disc removed from the mirror. I immediately removed it from the mirror itself and set it on the ground, whereupon it rolled back to the mirror and attached itself. But having not been placed there by a human hand, the mirror was only a looking glass, and the portal that to the other world and the horrors that it populated was for now sealed. I do not think I shall journey into that world again. The unclean monstrosity was enough. There is a certain irony in the fact that, as alien and terrifying as it was, the greatest evil to populate that land was man itself, for it was leaders of men who must have created the unclean to begin with, and who continued to allow their existence in order to perpetuate a reign of terror. The gun and Blackwood's tears I have brought back with me and shall keep so that the gun and the Blackwood's tears I have brought back with me shall likely prove of little use in this world, but I shall store them in my house in the country for now, for if the being that provided the tears to that earth ever visits our own, the compound may one day prove to be greatly useful. I visited Mr. Belson again today at Bedlam. I told him of my journey into his land, but what I had learned there I kept to myself. And I told him that I had means to return him to his land if he so desired. He declined. Having been gone so long and having vanished so suddenly, he would surely be under great suspicion if he were to return, and would likely be put to the tears, a fate that I now wish on no man. I have promised to vouch for him with the jailers and try to earn his release. I told him that when and if he becomes a free man, there shall be a position available for him in my household staff if he desires one. Deeds was very fascinated about my tale of my adventures into this parallel earth, and suggested I publish it. But who could believe such a fantasiful story of worlds accessible through looking glasses and gigantic horrors? Perhaps I shall present it as fiction in one of the penny journals that have become so popular among the working class. For whether they regard it as true or not, I suppose it does make for an interesting tale. And this ends Lord Blackwood in the Land of the Unclean. I really like this tale just because of... I just really think it's really interesting. I don't know. But I hope you guys really were also able to enjoy it. I know I messed up a lot, but you know what happens. And so, yeah, like I was saying, I'm going to start a new season. And I think I'm going to be looking at the SCP-01 proposals. So if you guys are interested, I'll see you in the next episode.